Hello there, Peabody here. Once again, it is time to take another revealing peek back into history.
What famous date shall I set it to today, Mr. Peabody?
All the way back to 2009 and Ruination, the early years.
Imagine waking up at 4:30 in the morning. You are dragging yourself through this tiny regional airport, and you board a cramped flight out of Charleston.
Sounds miserable already.
Right. But then you sit down, you look to your right, and you watch the person next to you crack open a Heineken and pour tomato juice into it.
Oh, gross. At what time?
At 6:45 a.m.
Unbelievable.
Yeah, welcome to May 2009. I'm your host, King.
And I am your expert guide, Gail.
And we are honestly just so glad you are sitting here with us for another month of Ruination. The early years.
Absolutely. If you are listening to this right now, you are officially the third person at this table as we sift through this incredibly specific digital time capsule.
Yeah, and our mission today is tracking the Big Fatty Online, or BFO, universe through a really fascinating trajectory.
We are looking at a month where the hyper-fixated, highly repetitive routines of the fat cave just violently collide with the raw, unfiltered reality of the physical world.
And what a collision it is. I mean, the month starts off peacefully enough, right?
Yeah, it does. We have Big Fatty waking up on the 1st of May and immediately saying, rabbit, rabbit, before his feet even hit the floor.
Which is that old superstition meant to guarantee 31 days of good luck.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It is this very human attempt to impose some kind of order on a completely chaotic universe. But, you know, if you follow this show, you know that any luck in this ecosystem is heavily laced with petty squabbles, bizarre side quests, and a really healthy dose of extreme couponing.
Oh, the couponing. We have to start with the couponing because the culinary fixations in this community, they are not just about what someone is eating for lunch.
No, definitely not.
Food is the engine for the drama. It is the primary catalyst for everything. And right out of the gate in May, we have an event that feels like a cultural hallucination now.
Oh, you mean the Oprah chicken incident?
Yes. Oprah Winfrey giving away free Kentucky grilled chicken on Cinco de Mayo.
Which is just a brilliant artifact of the era. You have to remember the context of 2009, right?
Right, the recession.
Exactly. We are deep in the recession. People are highly, highly motivated by a free meal. But when Oprah essentially commands her entire daytime viewing audience to log on and print a coupon, the infrastructure of the internet just completely buckles.
The servers at Oprah.com are totally overwhelmed. The site is crashing left and right.
But Big Fatty, he treats the acquisition of this two-piece chicken meal with the urgency of a high-stakes diamond heist.
Oh, it is priority number one. Nothing else matters.
And what makes it so compelling to look back on isn't just the fact that he wants free chicken. It's how he filters this massive monoculture, pop culture moment through his own extremely localized, budget-conscious worldview.
Yeah, Oprah is a billionaire, literally breaking the internet, and he just wants to make sure his local drive-thru honors the barcode.
Exactly. But the funny thing is, he isn't alone in these fast food trenches. The listeners are basically deputized as boots-on-the-ground intelligence agents.
It's so true. There is this listener named Stevie B, based in Baltimore, who actually conducts visual reconnaissance.
I love this part.
So Stevie B goes to a test market Chick-fil-A, orders the spicy chicken sandwich, specifically combo number 4, and sends in grainy cell phone photographic evidence.
And the critical piece of intelligence that Stevie reports back is that the sandwich comes without mayonnaise.
Which, I mean, sounds like a throwaway detail to anyone outside the community, right?
Right. Completely irrelevant to a normal person.
But here, it is vital data. Big Fatty has a profound, almost philosophical hatred of mayonnaise. He considers it vile.
So Stevie B isn't just reporting general fast food news. He has curated the information specifically for the host's distinct palate.
It is a global network of specialized spies.
It really is.
And then we have another listener who goes by Gumbo Guy, writing in with an entire historical dissertation on the McDonald's Big Mac.
Oh, Gumbo Guy. He notes it was born on May 4th, 1968, and originally cost 49 cents.
Right. But then Gumbo Guy introduces this brilliant architectural theory that he calls the bun surplus.
I love the bun surplus theory so much.
It is amazing. He points out that the middle bun of a Big Mac exists purely for structural integrity, just to keep the burger from sliding apart.
Right.
Therefore, eating a Big Mac creates an inherent, totally unnecessary surplus of bread in your diet.
And as an aside, While talking about this, he casually drops a recipe for something called heaving apple pancakes.
Heaving apple pancakes and bun surplus actually ends up being the title of the episode.
Which is exactly why this community is so sticky. They take the mundane mechanics of a fast food hamburger and elevate it to the level of a philosophical debate.
Yeah, they are looking at the architecture of their everyday lives and finding hidden meaning.
But, you know, hidden meaning can actually be kind of dangerous in this universe. Because food isn't just a source of joy or structural theory in May.
No, it is not.
It becomes the source of a massive, elaborate conspiracy. And here is where I really need to stop and ask for your help. Because I am genuinely baffled by how we get from point A to point B on this next story.
Okay, let's dig into it.
Okay, so we know from last month that Big Fatty suffered a pretty severe gastrointestinal disaster.
Right, he got a terrible stomach bug.
And the culprit was eating leftover stale popcorn from his office, the place he calls the coal mine.
Yeah.
Now, a normal person gets a stomach ache, throws out the bad popcorn, and moves on.
Right, in a normal world, yes, absolutely.
But a listener named Julie writes in. And she isn't just sending a standard get well soon message. She has engineered a full-blown assassination theory.
Oh, it's wild.
She firmly believes that Big Fatty's podcasting rival, Auntie Vera, who they call the Sea Hag, deliberately infiltrated his office and planted rancid popcorn to poison him.
Out of pure jealousy.
Right. Like, how does a listener make that leap? I mean, am I missing a crucial piece of lore here? Or is this just collective delusion?
You aren't missing anything, and it isn't delusion. It is a shared coping mechanism for the drudgery of normal life.
Okay, explain that.
Well, to understand Julie's leap, you have to look at the role of Auntie Vera. In the lore of the show, Auntie Vera is the established nemesis. Every good story needs a villain, right?
Right, the Sea Hag.
Exactly. If Big Fatty just gets a stomach ache from eating bad office snacks, that is a boring, frankly depressing reality about aging and bad decisions.
That makes sense.
But if his rival is orchestrating a covert poisoning attempt using stale popcorn, suddenly his life is a soap opera. The listeners are actively projecting these high-stakes Shakespearean betrayal plots onto his life because they want his daily routine to feel epic.
So they're essentially co-writing the show with him.
They really are. They are generating the narrative momentum, and that participatory nature is expanding so fast during this era.
It really is.
Big Fatty is increasingly becoming a filter for the bizarre realities of his audience. Take the listener Puff Freddy, for example. He sends in a YouTube link titled Bug Sleep.
Oh, this is such a great example of the contrast between the host's intent and the audience's application.
It really is. The video shows that playing the BFO deep dive literally puts Puff Freddy's child to sleep. The rhythm of this show is acting as a literal lullaby.
That is so funny.
And Big Fatty plays the audio of this sleeping kid on his show, and he is clearly amused by it, but he vehemently rejects the title of Nanny Fatty.
Well, yeah, because it threatens his entire brand positioning.
Totally.
He has built this persona of being a grumpy, ruined, prickly guy.
Yeah.
Broadcasting from a basement. And yet, the community keeps pulling him into these incredibly intimate, sweet domestic spaces.
Yeah, they are using his voice as a source of comfort, which is the very last thing he intended.
You see that exact same bizarre intimacy with the recurring character Kim Beaver.
Oh, Kim Beaver.
To give you some context, if you are listening, Kim Beaver is a listener who frequently chimes in with these highly eccentric observations.
Very eccentric.
In May, she sends in an audio file of a very strange, surprisingly sweet song that she claims is either sung by sheep or Viking women. She isn't sure which. And in the very same message, she firmly declares that chocolate ice cream is lesbian bacon.
Lesbian bacon. It is just a staggering combination of words.
It really is.
But it highlights something crucial about how deep the community is getting. They're developing a distinct dialect.
Oh, absolutely.
When you have a shared vocabulary like that, it acts as a cultural signifier. It proves you are part of the in-group.
But I have to ask, does that dialect risk alienating a new listener? Like, if you tune in for the first time and people are talking about the bun surplus, Sea Hag assassination plots, and lesbian bacon, isn't that just impenetrable?
It might be a steep learning curve, sure, but the friction is the point. Mm-hmm. The people who stick around feel a massive sense of ownership because they had to put in the work to understand the inside jokes.
That's a good point.
And we see that friction mirrored in the physical artifacts of the show, too.
Yes. The physical mail segment, we have an Australian listener who goes by Straight Bob, sending a package all the way from Melbourne.
All the way from Australia.
Big Fatty opens it on the air and it contains a Power Crunch protein bar and a pack of Australian Rules football cards.
Specifically featuring players like Trent Cotchin.
Right. But the detail that really struck me is the note. Straight Bob wrote this heartfelt, encouraging message on the back of a Commonwealth Bank debit slip.
That detail is a perfect time capsule of 2009. Think about the sheer effort required there.
Oh, it's monumental compared to today.
Today, if you want to encourage a creator, you double tap a screen or drop a frictionless digital comment. But Straight Bob had to find a scrap of paper from his bank, physically write out his thoughts, procure a protein bar, pack a box, and pay international shipping.
The effort alone communicates a profound level of investment.
It is a beautiful gesture. But as his global reach gets stronger, he is also getting pulled into the broader organized podcasting space. In May, he gets roped into participating in Pride 48.
For context, Pride 48 was a weekend-long, continuous live stream organized by another community figure, Daniel Beaver.
And the logistics of a continuous live stream in 2009 were practically a moon landing. The coordination alone is staggering.
Yeah, internet speeds alone made that a nightmare.
Exactly. Big Fatty is asked to record a promotional bumper for it, and he does it, but he does it with maximum sarcasm. He declares himself an international internet celebrity while refusing to drop his signature bad attitude.
He treats the entire collaboration like a chore he was forced to do by his mom.
Which is exactly what the audience wants from him.
Totally.
It makes me think of an analogy, actually. He is functioning like the central switchboard operator in a small town in the 1950s.
Okay, how so?
Well, he isn't necessarily the main character of these stories. He is just sitting at the desk, plugging the wires together. He connects the guy in Australia with the woman composing sheep songs and the guy taking covert photos of a Baltimore drive-thru. He is just facilitating.
I think that analogy falls a bit short, actually.
Really?
Because a switchboard operator is interchangeable. You can swap one out for another and the calls still go through. Big Fatty isn't interchangeable. He is the gravity of the whole system.
Ah, I see what you mean.
The reason this ecosystem works is because of his specific, rigid daily routine. If he were just a passive facilitator, the show would fly apart into random noise.
That makes a lot of sense.
The magic only happens because the audience's absurdities are bouncing off his highly specific, grumpy reality. He is the anchor.
Okay, yeah, the contrast is what makes it entertaining. And that anchor is about to get a massive stress test.
Oh, yes, it is.
Because while he has been acting as this digital gravity, well, from the safety of the Fat Cave, his online fame is about to smash directly into the physical world. He finally leaves the bunker.
The Chicago trip.
This is a fascinating study in what happens when a hyper-isolated digital creator steps into a massive in-person gathering. He travels to the International Mr. Leather or IML convention in Chicago.
And from the very first minute, the tonal shift is jarring.
The travel alone breaks his routine completely. It is grueling. He has to wake up at 4:30 a.m. to catch a flight out of what he endearingly calls Upchuck, meaning Charleston.
Which brings us back to the image from the start of our show.
Yes. He is sitting on this Delta flight, exhausted. And he watches a fellow passenger mix a Heineken with tomato juice at 6:45 in the morning.
The visceral disgust he expresses over that beverage is such a great detail.
It's so fun.
He is stepping out of his highly controlled environment where he dictates the menu and the lighting, and instantly he is confronted by the unpredictable, messy, gross habits of the general public.
But the real surrealism hits when he lands. He arrives at O'Hare Airport. He is descending the escalator toward baggage claim, and suddenly, out of the massive crowd, someone yells his catchphrase directly at him.
Ruined.
Exactly, ruined.
That has to be an incredibly disorienting moment. I mean, you spend your days talking into a microphone in a quiet room, and then you fly hundreds of miles away, and a total stranger echoes your own voice back to you in a massive transportation hub.
It's the moment the digital reach becomes a tangible reality. It manifests right in front of him.
And he leans into it, surprisingly.
He does. He hosts a hootenanny, which is his term for a meet and greet at Buck's Saloon on Halsted.
Right, in Chicago.
And for the first time, he is meeting core characters from the BFO universe in person. People like Omar and Denny, who have primarily existed as text on a screen or voices on a phone line, are suddenly standing next to him holding a drink.
What I find most compelling about this entire trip is how he chooses to report it back to his listeners. He does not give them a sanitized, glamorous version of a travel weekend.
Not at all. There is zero influencer gloss here. He gives them the blunt truth.
What be blunt?
He describes the sheer exhaustion of walking the leather market. He gives this detailed, almost sociological review of the vendor booths.
Oh, the booths.
He notes the bizarre emergence of 3D porn, where you actually have to wear those paper glasses. And he details the intense focus of the International Bootblack competition.
He really paints a vivid picture of the sensory overload.
But then, instead of partying until dawn, like everyone else at this massive convention, he tells his audience that he went back to his room at the Hilton, sat down in a chair, took his boots off, and just fell asleep sitting upright.
Just because his legs hurt.
Exactly. Because his legs hurt.
That is the kind of authenticity that modern creators spend thousands of dollars trying to manufacture, you know?
Totally.
He is at one of the biggest, most intense party weekends of the year, and his primary takeaway is foot pain and a desperate need for a nap.
And yet, right alongside the naps, he maintains this intense transparency about his romantic life.
Oh, yes.
He details a multi-hour visit from a gentleman caller. He explains that he met this man on a hookup app, which he discreetly calls the Grin Doctor, and describes him as a Native American former college basketball player.
He just casually lays out the timeline of this rendezvous for his entire audience.
It is a staggering level of candor. There is zero separation between the guy complaining about the tomato juice beer, the guy falling asleep in a chair, and the guy detailing his romantic encounters in a Chicago hotel room.
It is all the exact same guy.
Which makes me think of, like, a cozy sitcom character suddenly walking onto the set of a gritty HBO show.
Oh, the tonal whiplash is intense.
If you look at modern content creation, most hosts meticulously separate their brand from their explicit private lives. Big Fatty just dumps everything into the exact same feed.
Everything.
So my question to you is, does this level of radical sharing actually risk alienating his audience? Or is this complete lack of boundaries the exact mechanism that creates such fanatical loyalty?
Oh, it is undeniably the mechanism of loyalty.
Isn't so?
Absolutely. When you scrub away the messy, the intimate, or the explicit details of your life, you create a very safe, polished product. But you also create a massive wall of distance between yourself and the listener.
That's very true.
By sharing the exhaustion, the naps, the petty grievances, and the highly personal romantic details, he is signaling to the audience that he trusts them implicitly. He isn't putting on a performance for a demographic. He is existing alongside them.
He is treating them like real friends.
Exactly. That lack of boundaries transforms a passive listener into a confidant.
Which perfectly summarizes the incredible duality of May 2009. The BFO masterfully weaves the deeply mundane worries of Oprah coupons, spicy chicken reconnaissance, and stale popcorn conspiracies with the wild, unfiltered reality of the Chicago IML weekend.
It really proves that extreme vulnerability, whether it is about your digestive tract or your dating life, is the ultimate tool for community building.
It truly is a masterclass in early digital connection. He takes the massive macro events of the world and makes them hyper-micro. And he takes his micro basement-level life and broadcasts it to the world.
And looking ahead, the chaos in the BFO universe isn't slowing down at all.
Oh, definitely not. Big Fatty returns to the Fat Cave from Chicago just in time to prepare for Miss West arriving.
Right, for the highly anticipated barbecue eating tour of the South.
You can only imagine the culinary and digestive reports that are going to generate.
I imagine the coal mine will be producing plenty of updates.
For you listening, we want to invite you to come back next Saturday for another month of Ruination, the early years.
And please remind yourself to tune in each Sunday for Ruination Repeat, which recaps last week's current BFO episodes.
As always, I am King.
And I am Gail.
And we want to leave you with a final thought to ponder off air today. Think back to that opening idea of waking up and saying, rabbit, rabbit, to control the chaos.
Yeah.
If Big Fatty had started his show today armed with slick editing software, algorithmic managers, and the crushing pressure to be brand safe for corporate sponsors, would he have ever cultivated this level of profound intimacy?
It's a great question.
Or was the clunky, unpolished, friction-filled internet of 2009 the only environment where a show this beautifully messy could actually survive and thrive? Keep that in mind. We'll see you next time.
Well, we hope you enjoyed today's trip down memory lane on Ruination the Early Years. Join us again next weekend. We'll see you then.